While spending a lot of time at home more often recently, I found myself a brand new hobby, jigsaw puzzles. I'm lucky enough that Unidragon have sponsored this episode of Morbidology. They create and sell premium sets of wooden jigsaw puzzles, and offer jigsaw puzzles for both adults and children to entertain all experience levels. What I love about Unidragon jigsaw puzzles is how beautiful they are. They're perfect for people who love nature and animals, with names like the majestic wolf, the alluring unicorn, and the charming owl. Jigsaw puzzles are a great way to pass the time. It's a fun, low-stakes activity which can help reduce anxiety, and even increase your memory and problem-solving skills. Also, it's super satisfying when you finally complete one, and they're fun to collect as well. So head on over to unidragon.com and click the link in my show notes and use the code DRAGONBEFORE for 10% off. That's DRAGONBEFORE for 10% off. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Wellington, Ohio, is a quaint village around 40 miles southwest of Cleveland, surrounded by rolling fields. In 2007, it was the scene of a grisly crime that would cause irreversible damage to a well-known and well-loved family, and in the aftermath, would reignite the debate over teenagers and violent video games. It was Friday evening in Wellington, Ohio, on the 20th of October 2007, when local police were called out to a modest three-bedroom, ranch-style home. It was the home of the Petrick family, which consisted of 45-year-old Mark, 43-year-old Susan, and their three children, 21-year-old Heidi, 17-year-old Holly, and 16-year-old Daniel. Before moving to Wellington, the Petricks were youth and associate pastors at East Gate Assembly of God, located near Columbus. They had worked as house parents for troubled teens at the Choice Place Boys Home in Ashland. Then in 2003, the family moved into a 7-acre home in Wellington. Here, Mark took up the role as pastor at New Life Assembly of God. As Hal Stiles, a member of the church, said, "Mark and his family were easy to love. They were just like the rest of us." Susan was described as the perfect pastor's wife. She was known for always wanting to help people, but she also had a mischievous side. Kathy Stiles, a member of the church, recollected how on one occasion, Susan brought along a whoopee cushion to a ladies' lunch meeting. Susan also worked at a Wellington nursery home as a bookkeeper, and was said to be sensitive and had a deep compassion for children and often filled in at the Sunday school class. Daniel had been homeschooled in Columbus, but when they moved to Wellington, he was enrolled at Wellington High School, where he was a sophomore. Daniel was slap bang in the middle of his class, earning a 2.7 grade point average. He enjoyed skateboarding, playing the drums, and playing on Xbox. His friends all said that he was always upbeat and loved to clown around, much like his mother. The family all attended church together weekly, and Daniel had competed with other churches on a Bible Challenge team on their knowledge of the Bible. His coach, Stephanie Maybar, said that Daniel was intelligent and friendly. He was said to be the best player on the church's Bible quiz team and could quote verbatim long verses from the Bible. Heidi also served as youth pastor with her husband, Andrew, at New Life Assembly of God, while Holly was a senior at Wellington High School. At around 7 p.m. on that fateful evening, Heidi Archer and her husband Andrew had arrived at the family home shortly before 7 p.m. They had been invited over to watch the Cleveland Indians play the Boston Red Sox in the American League Championship Series. When Heidi arrived at the front door, Daniel appeared and tried to prevent them from entering the home. It goes without saying that this was extremely suspicious and completely out of character. Heidi and Andrew managed to barge their way into the family home. They were met by a bloodbath. Inside the living room, they found Mark and Susan on perpendicular couches. Susan had been shot in the head and through both forearms, while Mark had been shot once in the face. They rushed to Susan and found that she had no pulse, then rushed to Mark and found that Mark was still clinging to life. It was evident that the wounds were extremely recent, and a 9mm was found at the scene. Andrew administered first aid to Mark, while Heidi called 911.
What's going on?
I don't know what happened. I just came over to my parents' house because we were going to watch the game. And my mom is shot and my dad is shot. My brother's here.
Does anybody know what happened? Did your brother shoot your parents?
I don't know. I do know.
As Heidi was on the phone to the 911 operator, Daniel placed a phone call to Andrew's brother, Stephen Archer, who lived in Medina County. Daniel and Andrew were friends, and after hanging up the phone, Daniel fled the house in the family's Ford Windsor minivan and began to drive to Stephen's home. At around 7:10 p.m., however, Daniel was pulled over by Wellington police and arrested. While being arrested, Daniel shouted that his father had shot his mother and then shot himself.
My dad, he shot my mom and he shot himself.
My dad shot my mom!
Why would my dad shoot my mom?
I don't know, man.
Tragically, Susan was pronounced dead at the scene, but Mark was still alive. He was rushed to Metro Health Medical Center in Cleveland, where he was said to be in critical condition, but in and out of consciousness. He had a bullet lodged in his lower jaw. Captain Rich Resendez of the Lorain County Sheriff's Office said that the first aid that Andrew had administered to Mark had potentially saved his life. On the Sunday following the shooting, more than 75 members of New Life Assembly of God clambered into the church for the weekly service and to comfort each other in the wake of the tragedy. Typically, Mark would have run this service, but Joel Souza, a former pastor, stepped in. Turning to the congregation, he said, "We're not here to answer the two questions we all want answered. What happened and why? Let's not even try to answer those questions because we can't until more information comes out." By the Monday, investigators would announce that they had a main suspect in the murder, and it was 16-year-old Daniel. While being questioned, Daniel had stuck to the story that his father had murdered his mother and then shot himself in the head.
My dad was just yelling, just screaming at my mom. And then I heard my dad walk in the room.
And walk
into his bedroom. And then walk back out.
I ran out there and my mom had been shot. He pointed the gun at me. And then he said he was sorry, and then he shot himself.
However, Daniel seemingly didn't anticipate that his father would survive the shooting and tell Heidi that it was Daniel who shot both of them before he fell unconscious. In a press conference, Captain Resendez said, "We believe that Daniel is the sole person responsible for this tragedy. He's given us some details about what occurred, and indicated some of his reasoning, but were not discussing any motive at this time. He said that Daniel had confessed to shooting his parents, and had offered some kind of explanation as to why, but said that they would not be releasing that information just yet. When speaking with investigators, Daniel was said to be calm. He expressed sorrow, but otherwise showed almost no semblance of emotion. Captain Resendez said that he had been cooperative and it appeared as though he was trying to tie up some loose ends, at least in his own mind. He also asked the investigators to pass on his concern to the family. He indicated he was ready to accept his responsibility, but we're dealing with a 16-year-old, and I'm not sure that he understands. It would be revealed that Mark's own 9mm handgun had been used in the shooting and left at the crime scene, and investigators believed that the two wounds to Susan's forearms were defensive wounds and had been caused before she was fatally shot in the head. That same day, Daniel would appear before a juvenile magistrate to be charged with murder and attempted murder. His defense attorney, Jim Kersey, requested that Daniel be released into the custody of his grandfather, Michael Brockle, and Michael said to Judge David Bertha that Daniel had already been forgiven by his parents and by God, stating, "Daniel has been a loving child all of his life. He has never given anyone any trouble. If his mother and father were sitting here, they would forgive him too." Judge David Bertha turned down the request and ordered that Daniel remain at the Lorain County Detention Home. The following day, Daniel appeared in court once more to hear the formal charges, which were delinquency reason of murder and felonious assault. Magistrate Stephen Blake announced that it was mandatory that Daniel's case be sent to the Common Pleas Court, which meant that he would be tried as an adult, not a juvenile. Attorney John Otero was appointed the legal guardian of Daniel, which meant that he would represent Daniel in the capacity of what a parent or legal guardian would normally do. It was expected that he would serve this role until the case was sent to Common Pleas Court. News of the arrest swept through the area like a tidal wave, and many were left wondering if there were signs that had somehow been missed. Daniel had never exhibited violence around his friends or in school, with Superintendent Victor Cardenzana saying, "There's nothing that would profile him as a source of violence." One classmate, Valerie Valuna, said that when Daniel got mad at school, he would just keep to himself. He wouldn't lash out at anybody. However, according to Captain Resendez, there were conflicting stories regarding Daniel, and investigators would need to look into whether there were warning signs of violence or whether Daniel truly was a decent teenager who got into serious trouble for the first time in his life. On the 25th of October, Judge David Bertha granted Daniel a 30-minute furlough so that he could say goodbye to his mother who he shot and killed. His defense team had originally requested permission for Daniel to attend Susan's funeral, but the judge refused, and instead granted him permission to view her body in the church briefly. He was allowed a supervised visit by a court employee and sheriff's deputies, and no family members were allowed to be present. On granting the furlough, Judge Bertha said he needed to think about the long-term psychological effects, adding that Daniel would have to live with what he had done for the rest of his life. Prosecutor Tom Sillo had asked the judge to deny the request, stating that it was distasteful because Mark, who still remained in hospital, would not have the same opportunity. At around 1 p.m, Daniel was driven by jail van to the New Life Assembly of God. The following day, Susan's funeral was held at the Avon Christian Heritage Centre on Chester Road. Around 500 loved ones of the Petrick family attended the service. Reverend Stephen Conrad of Eastgate Assembly of God Church said, "We're gathering not to answer unanswerable questions. We're here to celebrate the life of our sister." During the service, Susan was remembered as a serious football fan with a mischievous giggle. While Daniel's name was mentioned several times throughout the service, there was absolutely no mention of what he had been accused of doing. Afterwards, Susan was buried in Greenwood Cemetery. The following week, Judge David Berta ruled that Daniel would be tried as an adult and set his bond to $1 million. According to Daniel's attorney, James Kersey, Daniel would have pleaded guilty to the murder if the case remained in juvenile court. This meant that he would have been released when he turned 21 years old. However, now he was facing life in prison if convicted. Outside of court, attorney Kersey said he had offered the plea simply because a guilty conviction in juvenile court would be substantially lower than a conviction in criminal court. Following the hearing, Daniel was moved from the juvenile detention home to the county jail, where he was to be segregated from the adult inmates. Mark would finally be discharged from hospital in November. His jaw had been broken by the gunshot wound and remained swollen on one side, while he had a large gash on the side of his scalp, from where doctors had opened his skull to relieve bleeding on the brain. Thankfully, Mark suffered no kind of brain damage. Speaking with the Chronicle Telegram, he said that he had met with his son at the Lorain County Jail, and that he had forgiven him for what he had done, stating, "I do have a lot of forgiveness in my heart now, thanks to God." He said for around 2 weeks after he awoke from his coma, he felt anger towards his son, but said that through the prayer of God, he had forgiven his son. He further said that Daniel had recommitted his life to Christianity and spent his days behind bars writing letters to his family. Mark would speak with Crime Watch Daily.
"I'm laying there in bed. Just, why did he do this? I said, God, I hate that kid. I hate him. He's my son, but I hate him. And so I told God, you know what? The next time I see him, I'm going to kill him." When I began to pray for Danny, who I considered my enemy, the love came through, and that's when the forgiveness came through.
Before the year came to an end, Daniel appeared in court via video link from jail, where he pleaded not guilty to aggravated murder and attempted aggravated murder. Shortly thereafter, prosecutors would file court documents, which objected family visits for Daniel. Daniel had asked for the judge to reduce his bond and asked to be allowed contact visits with his family, but prosecutor Tony Sillo strongly opposed those requests, writing, "The defendant sought a 9mm firearm locked in his father's gun safe. He entered the living room and told his parents to shut their eyes because he had a surprise for them. At that point, he shot his father one time on the left side of his head and his mother three times, killing her." Prosecutors said that they had a strong case against Daniel, adding that in large part, he had confessed to what he had done. Defence Kersey said he had hoped that the court would at least allow Daniel's bond to be reduced, so that he would have to pay 10% of his $1 million bond to be released from jail. They also wanted the judge to grant Mark minister status at the Lorain County Jail. Minister Steeris would allow Mark to visit Daniel in jail and claim privileged talks with him. Prosecutor Sillo also strongly opposed to this, stating that the court would be forced to determine whether the communications between Mark and Daniel would be from a minister's standpoint or from a father's standpoint. After all, Mark would be a key witness during the murder trial. Ultimately, the judge would rule that Mark could be granted minister status and visit his son in jail. While such conversations would typically be kept private, the conversations between Mark and Daniel could become part of the upcoming murder trial. Mark would have to abide by rules and regulations, which would be established by the county sheriff regarding clergy visits. These clergy visits are a lot more lenient than regular visits with inmates. Members of the clergy who are cleared to visit are able to visit an unlimited number of times, as opposed to once a week. The murder case went to trial in December of the following year. It was decided that it would be a bench trial as opposed to a jury trial, which meant that a single judge would determine Daniel's fate. There had been very little information regarding the case or a potential motivation. But during opening statements, the prosecution said they believed that Daniel had murdered his mother and attempted to murder his father because he was angry that Mark had not allowed him to play an Xbox game, Halo. They revealed that before the shooting, Daniel had snuck out of the family's home from his bedroom window to purchase the game Halo. Mark and Susan had caught him as he tried to sneak back inside the house with the game and confiscated it from him. Mark placed the Xbox game in a lockbox where he also kept his 9mm handgun. Around a month later, Daniel took the game and the gun out of the lockbox. They suggested that Daniel had attempted to set the scene up as a murder-suicide and then fled from the home with the Halo game.
Afterwards, you will hear from Mark Petrie, although reluctantly, that while he was sitting there gurgling and dying, his son tried to place the gun in his hand. Hold on to the gun, Dad, hold on to the gun. Only because, unexpectedly, Heidi and Andy come to the door. More prior calculation than I can show, Your Honor. The defendant walks to the door, cracks it open, puts his head out, says, "You don't want to come in here, not a good time." They push their way in because they could hear Mark Petrie struggling. And they found the scene of murder. You will hear a 911 tape as part of the evidence, Your Honor, where he picks up the firearm again. It may have been appearing to load it. You will hear Heidi Petrie saying, put that down, screaming. You will hear how Andy was forced to rush and take the firearm away, clear it, giving him the clip out. And then the defendant took off. And he began to make up his story of murder-suicide.
Daniel's defense team said that Daniel had been under intense stress because of a snowboarding accident, which had resulted in a severe staph infection. It had left Daniel with such severe spinal damage that even the slightest injury could leave him paralyzed. They said that he was stuck at home for an entire year with nothing to do other than watch television and play video games. He said that it was during this time that Daniel had become obsessed with Halo, and would go to his friends' homes and play the game for hours on end. However, his parents had forbidden him from purchasing the game because they felt as though it was too violent and sexually explicit.
He was always particularly close to his mother and father. Up to the 20th of October, there was never a moment of violence towards them, threats, anger, aggressiveness at all. And ultimately, on 20 October, why we're here. This awful, terrible tragedy. At approximately 7:15, Danny Petrick, without a distinct process of reasoning, without a scheme, and after a momentary consideration, shot and killed his mother and shot his father. And without prior calculation and design. The state's theory on counts 1 and 4, I disagree with it. I think the court will disagree with once you find all the evidence that it was something other than with prior calculation and design. It is some other sort of murder, perhaps. And I would wish the court to consider that, and I know you do, you'll make a fair and equitable decision in this regard. Thank you, Your Honor.
The first witness to testify was Mark. He wiped a tear from his eye as he recollected how on that fearful evening, Daniel had entered the living room and said, "Would you guys close your eyes? I have a surprise for you." Mark testified that he was expecting a pleasant surprise, but moments later, a loud shot rang out, and his head went numb. He had just been shot once in the head. After shooting him and then shooting and killing Susan, Daniel shoved the gun back in Mark's hand and said, "Hey, Dad, here's your gun. Take it." He broke down in tears on the witness stand as he recollected how he heard his daughter arrive at the home and heard Daniel telling them that they couldn't come in. Mark said that all he could do was make a guttural yell for help. Mark told the courtroom how when he visited his son in jail, he apologized for what he had done, allegedly stating, "Dad, I'm so sorry for what I did to Mum, to you, and to the family. I'm so glad that you're alive." Mark said that Daniel had told him that he could hardly live with the guilt of what he had done, and that he would just cry all the time. He said that Daniel and Susan had a very close relationship, stating, He was always her little boy. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and they're today's sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counseling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counseling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counseling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counselors specializing in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counselor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. Heidi and Andrew testified that when they arrived at the family's home, Daniel had tried to stop them from coming inside, telling them that Mom and Dad had a big argument. They said that they heard a moan coming from inside the home and pushed their way past Daniel and found Mark and Susan. Mark, through his shattered jaw, managed to say that his own son had shot them both, while Daniel tried to blame Mark, claiming that his father had shot his mother and then shot himself. Heidi explained how she immediately called 911, before realizing that Daniel had picked up the 9mm gun. However, Andrew demanded he give the gun back to him, and Daniel complied, without resistance. Daniel then ran out of the house and fled in the family's van. He was arrested shortly thereafter, and the Halo game was sitting on the front seat. Heidi testified that the family had forgiven Daniel for what he had done, and said that they wanted him to come home, because they couldn't heal until they were all together. The defense would call for other witnesses, and they attempted to put forward the theory that Daniel's obsession with video games may have led to the murder. They called a friend of Daniel, 17-year-old Jonathan Johnson. It was revealed that Daniel had temporarily lived with Jonathan and his family, when Mark had kicked him out of the house in the weeks before the shooting. Mark and Daniel had an argument over Halo, and Mark told him to leave the house if he could not give up with his video game addiction. Defense Kersey asked Jonathan, "Out of a 24-hour day, how long would you play?" He replied, "Maybe 16 to 18 hours." He said that Daniel was obsessed with video games and said that he had never shown any anger or said any bad comments about his parents in the past. Daniel's sister Holly would give similar testimony to Daniel's teenage friend. She said that he would play Xbox non-stop and would only take a break once in a while to get something to eat. Daniel's grandfather, Michael, would testify that Daniel had shown remorse for his actions. He told the courtroom, "He leaped in my arms and was sobbing. His exact words to me were, 'Grandpa, I'm so sorry. I killed Mom and...'" Michael became so overcome with emotion that he couldn't finish that sentence. During the trial, juvenile psychologist Stephen Niehaus presented a report from his interactions with Daniel. He said that Daniel had told him that he had planned the murder of his parents for a week, and had told him, "Now that I was 16, I wanted to make my own decisions, not live by their rules." During closing arguments, Defense Kersey didn't contest that Daniel had shot and killed his mother and shot his father. He described him as a typical 16-year-old boy who just popped and suggested that he should be found not guilty by reason of insanity. He argued that Daniel's video game addiction made him less responsible and said that the murders hadn't been planned. Instead, he suggested that Daniel had gone to the lockbox to find the Halo game and then killed his parents in a spur-of-the-moment crime, when he noticed the gun sitting alongside the video game. Countering this, Prosecutor Sillow described Daniel as a cold and calculating killer, who who plotted the murder of his parents to make it appear as though it were a murder-suicide. He reminded the courtroom that the psychologist, who was hired by the defense, testified that Daniel had told him that he had planned the murders for around a week, which completely countered the closing statements of the defense, who claimed it was a spur-of-the-moment crime. He stated, he built the plan around the arrival of his sister and her husband at 9 p.m. They were coming to the house to watch the Indians game. He had planned for them to find the bodies. But when Heidi showed up 2 hours early, she interfered with the plan. Following the closing arguments, Judge James Burge said that he would announce his verdict in January. On the 11th of January, everybody shuffled back into the courtroom for the verdict to be returned. Judge Burge found Daniel Patrick guilty of aggravated murder and attempted aggravated murder. He said that while Daniel may have been addicted to video games, the evidence in the case showed that he had planned the murder. He explained his verdict and said that there were merits to Daniel's defense's claims, but said that the law required more to establish the defense. He said, I firmly believe that Daniel Patrick had no idea at the time he hatched this plot, that if he killed his parents, they would be dead forever. I think that is the state of mind that this young man was in at the time of these events. The death would not be permanent. He said he considered that Daniel may have believed that much like the characters in Halo, his parents would respawn. As the verdict was read out, Daniel showed no emotion. Mark, who was holding back tears, said, I love you, Danny, as Daniel was led out of the courtroom. With a guilty verdict, Daniel was now facing a maximum possible sentence of life in prison, without the possibility of parole. In June, Daniel was back in court to be sentenced for his crimes. Mark pleaded with the judge to be lenient on his son, stating that he regretted what he had done and reminds him often that he's glad he survived.
I write this letter on behalf of my son, Danny Petrick. Danny has had to face and is now facing the very serious consequences of what he did on October 20th, 2007. I know, without any doubt, he has severe regret, remorse, and guilt of what he did to his mom and I that evening. I can't count the number of times he has told me that he's so sorry for what he did that he'll never be able to forgive himself. I can also count the number of times he has told me that he's so happy that I survived and so glad to still be able to see me. He's told me that numerous times. I love you, Danny. I can't count the number of times that he said, Dad, I miss Mom. I miss Mom. His pain runs very deep, and it should. I believe it should run deep. And if his pain did not run deep, I guarantee you I would not be standing here speaking on his behalf. I call him like I see him. And I would not stand here and talk on his behalf if his pain didn't run deep. I know it does, contrary to others' opinions. So I'm asking the court on Danny's behalf for a lenient sentence. I'm not sure Danny does have remorse and regret. And I believe God is a God of forgiveness and a God of second chances. Although God does not remove consequences, he doesn't. But he does give second chances. And I'm asking that Danny, in his lifetime, would have a second chance to be successful and do something positive and constructive. And I believe that even through this horrible circumstance, that Danny can set an example for other young people not to get involved and do the things that he did. And I believe he can do that. I believe that may be a calling upon his life to do that. Thank you.
He said that a sentence short of life without parole would give his son a second chance and to make up for what he had done. The prosecution disputed that Daniel showed remorse for his actions, and asked the judge to impose the maximum sentence of life in prison. Prosecutor Sillow said that Daniel had already received a break because he was under 18 years old when the murder had taken place, and therefore ineligible for the death penalty.
Daniel chose, in the words of his father, to, he referred to him in his interview as a pathological liar. Daniel has serious problems telling the truth. Daniel knows how to manipulate. His brain really works. Those are the words of his father when he was interviewed, Your Honor. And that's what's happened here. If you look at exactly what occurred, they take away the video game before he's had a chance to play it. That he admitted that his mother was likely to allow him to play the games. His father would be the problem. What does that make, Susan Petrie? Collateral damage? Because he chose to shoot both of them. That to escape what he was going to do, he decided to kill both of them and to make it look like a murder-suicide. That he had to steal the key to the gun cabinet to accomplish this. That the game was in there, and yes, he took it afterwards, but he also had to load the gun. That he was able to pretend that things were going well, walk out of a room and say, I've got a surprise for you, please close your eyes. And then he opened fire. But he opened fire in a very methodical manner. The father first, the biggest target, also to make it look like the suicide, and then the mother, three shots from across the room. His hand was steady. This is not a shaking addict having trouble with his thought process.
Ultimately, Daniel was sentenced to 23 years to life in prison. As the verdict was read out, he shook his head slightly, snuffled, and then held back tears. He sat back down without saying a word. In 2011, Mark publicly spoke about the actions of his son. He said that after Daniel's snowboarding accident, he was bored in the house, so his parents allowed him to buy an Xbox to play video games with his friends. He said that at first, Daniel only played sporting games, and then started to play Halo 3. Mark explained that when he saw the game and saw how extremely violent and gory it was, he confiscated it from his son. He said to Fox News, "My son Danny was angry with us." He said that when he first learned that his wife had died when he awoke from his coma, he first of all felt anger towards his son, telling Fox, "I was so angry. I wanted to kill him, and I told God that." He said he had planned on never seeing Daniel again, but said that God had different plans for him. He said that he was reminded of the words of Jesus on the cross, "Forgive them, Father, they know not what they do," and said that he was enabled to forgive his son. He said that his mission was now to try and get violent video games away from children, and stated that violent video games put weapons in the hands of children and teach them to murder and teach them that killing is okay. 2 years later, ABC News correspondent Deborah Roberts went to the Mansfield Correctional Centre to interview Daniel.
So tell me about that day, October 20th. How did you wind up with a gun in your hand?
We always did a lot of hunting and a lot of target shooting. So there was a lot of guns in the house. I went and got the gun from my dad's closet.
Why did you go get the gun to begin with?
I was angry at my dad. He was firm about it, adamant about it, that there would be none of this, and that's the way it was going to be. And so that created a lot of resentment and a lot of anger.
So did you think, I'm going to go get a gun, and I'm going to kill my dad?
I did. I went in my room and I was mad. I told my dad, hang on, I got something I want to show you. I went and grabbed a gun and...
Your dad said that you came out and you said, close your eyes.
Right.
And then you fired the gun.
Mm-hmm.
At your mom first.
No, it was at my dad first.
Do you remember that look on her face? Did you think that you were just hurting them? Or did you think that you were killing them?
I didn't understand. Like I said, I was a teenager at the time. There's a difference between knowing something and understanding something, and understanding that I was taking a human life.
You're seeing the blood on your parents, on your mom. What were you feeling at that moment?
Mom used to playing these games, and at the end of every round, everything just resets. At the end of every level, everybody's still there.
But you're 16 years old. I mean, you've got to know your parents aren't going to reset after you fire this gun at them. Are you blaming the video game for what you did?
No.
The actions of Daniel led to much debate regarding video games and violence. It reignited the old rap music makes kids violent debate from the 1990s. There are a lot of people who say that video games can cause juveniles to commit heinous acts of violence. According to Massachusetts Institute of Technology professor Henry Jenkins, who studied the phenomenon, this is simply a myth. He wrote that new research has found that video games are a primary factor, or that violent video games could turn an otherwise normal person into a killer. Professor Andrew Prisbilski, director of research at the Oxford Internet Institute, also conducted a study and found no relationship between violent video games and aggressive behaviour in teenagers. He stated, "The idea that violent video games drive real-world aggression is a popular one, but it hasn't tested very well over time. A better argument would be whether video games, regardless of whether they are violent or not, are a legitimate form of addiction." Then in 2013, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders identified gaming addiction as a disorder. It noted that gaming must cause significant impairment or distress in several aspects of a person's life. 2 years later, Daniel appealed his conviction, citing a number of reasons, one of which was a failure to suppress evidence. Before his trial, Defence Kersey had submitted a motion to suppress evidence and stated that because Daniel was only 16 years old when first interrogated, he did not understand what it meant to waive his Miranda rights. He had also stated that investigators continued to question Daniel, even after he told them that he didn't want to discuss the crimes any longer. In Daniel's appeal, he wrote that Defence Kersey did not properly convey to him that he could or should file a timely appeal. He said that Defence Kersey had told him that the legislation of diminished capacity in Ohio was under review and would very likely be changed within the next year or so, and he had allegedly told him that when the legislation was changed, Daniel would be able to go back to court and would very likely receive a more lenient sentence. Daniel said that after learning this, he had been studying the effects that violent video games had on juveniles and had hoped that his studies would help him if he were ever granted a new trial. However, Daniel was then informed by Gregory Dew, a legal clerk at Trumbull Correctionals Institution, that any change in legislation would only apply to him if they are held as retroactive, and that Daniel would have to appeal if he wanted his case reviewed. Daniel's appeal was denied, and he remains incarcerated at the Trumbull Correctional Institution.
I know what he did is wrong, but, you know, he has true remorse. He really does. He's so sorry for what he did. And I know he wouldn't do it again. I know that.
Violent video games did not kill Susan Patrick. Daniel Patrick did. There is no knowing that if Daniel's parents had taken away his car or banned him from seeing his friends, he would not have responded in a similar way, lashing out with extreme violence. For people to blame video games or even blame music or television for someone else's actions is extremely misguided and faults the symptoms as opposed to the true issue. Daniel's family, including his father, sisters, and grandparents, have all forgiven him for his actions that day and continue to visit him weekly in prison. They still cling on to the hope that one day, Daniel will be free. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Jalissa and Sean. I'm eternally grateful for your support. It helps to defray the costs of Freedom of Information requests, hosting, archive subscriptions, and much, much more. In return for your support on Patreon, you get Morbidology merch, exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, bonus content from some episodes, including case files, ad-free and early release episodes, and you can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. You can join for as little as $1 a month. There's absolutely no obligations. You can cancel any time. I'd also like to mention again that I'm up on the app Stereo and I've been doing live streams about true crime. Just click the link in my show notes and come and visit me there. You can join in on the live streams and chat with me. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, True Crime Files. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hi, I'm Christine, and I'd like to introduce you to the True Crime Files podcast, a bi-weekly podcast that focuses on mysterious disappearances and unsolved murders. Every 2 weeks, we'll be releasing an episode that'll help you get to know a case really well without having to invest a lot of your time. Derived from the articles up on the True Crime Files website, you'll find that our show covers a diversity of victims and perspectives. You'll probably also notice that our episodes are narrated by Scott Fuller from the Frozen Truth and Status Pending podcasts. Be sure to subscribe to the True Crime Files today so that you never miss an episode. Thanks so much for listening, being a part of our true crime community, and helping to shine a light on cases that might otherwise be overlooked or underreported.